Hello, and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from Skepticamp 2024 and was recorded in front of a live audience in Manchester on the 18th of October 2024. A video of this, and many of the recordings hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online, are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you would like to support what we do, you can join our Patreon. Find us at Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub, online.
And the next speaker is an archaeologist and the host of a podcast Digging Up Ancient Aliens with a specialization in Scandinavian Vikings and stuff like that. So, those aliens. With the talk called A Priest, a Viking and a Sea Monster Walked into a Lake. And I appreciate pronunciation, Frederick Trusoham.
So, I'm Frederick, and usually I discuss pseudo-archaeology and the silliness of ancient aliens and all this, but this time I want to talk about something more serious, lake monsters. This is primarily how these legends can be created, but also how they can serve as a source for, well, history and belonging, identity to a region, and how they can cost taxpayer money. So while there are many great lake monsters out there, nobody can really beat the beast living in Storsjön, that's in the middle of Sweden, but still in the northern part of Sweden. And Storsjön translates to big lake, so this is the big lake monster. And Storsjöodjuret, while Loch Ness might be more famous and Lazario from Lago di Como near Milan has a better fashion sense, they can't really beat Storsjöodjuret because it has something really interesting, a runestone connected to it. And these And this stone plays an integral part of the legend of this monster. And the legend was first documented by a Danish priest named Mogens Petersen in 1635. In this version, we learn that two trolls created this monster by accident, by boiling water for several weeks. And the monster that sprung from this pot started to become a nuisance for the region. So they called in a magician, Ketil Runske, who come there and start to stop the monster. And in some legends, this magician is called Gudfast or Godsteady, because it's a name on the runestone. But the magician bind the beast to a little island in the center of this lake by using this runestone. And the tail is stuck about 4 kilometers away from the runestone, so the head is a very large monster. And according to the legend, the serpent might become free if somebody interprets these runes. Now, this is a strange lock to put on your beast cage because, well, runes were used in Sweden up until the 1900s, but the language when the runestone was created and the language in the 1600s was very different. Now, the story has become such an integral part that the stone supposedly was smashed by a criminal trying to escape the police, hoping that the newly released sea monster would stop the policeman, so he could escape his pursuer. Now, what is interesting here is the runestone itself. It's the most northern runestone we have. And it's interesting also because it followed the same style as the runestones we find in the central part of Sweden, where we find almost 40% of the world's runestones. And we can actually date the runestone based on its design. So if we look at it, we can see, looking at the head especially, we can see that this was most likely carved between 1050 and 1080 CE. And the text followed the typical formula we find on runestone in the middle of Sweden. And it says something like that. Argu, Hermalus, Velda Lupe, Zas, wait, no. If somebody feel the effect of a curse, see me after. This was the wrong translation. Bring cash. What we really see on the runestone is a classic formula with a twist. We have who made the stone on it and who it was dedicated to. In this case, it was a person called Östman who dedicated stone to himself. It's not uncommon on runestones. They mostly create as a memorial stone to somebody who died, but it's not uncommon to see them as bragging points. I did this, I did that, I have a lot of power. And in a sense, the runestones can serve as, served a bit like the Viking Age Instagram. The most prolific bragger was a man called Jarla Banke. His family has created 20 runestones we know about, and they are located in Stockholm. And Jarla Banke himself brags about how many bridges he built, and he raised five stones for himself, not to somebody else. And it's the same thing we see here in... I think I'm on the wrong side. It's the same thing we see on this stone. It's a man called Östman who dedicated this to himself, and he brags about a bridge he built and that he Christianized the whole of Jämtland, the area where this stone is put up. So as I said, both the stone and the legend is important from a regional identity perspective. So if you go to Östersund, you will see that the monster is everywhere. It's on garbage cans, it's on the tourism board's logo, you find it everywhere. And the picture can be found, it's even an exhibition regarding the monster on the local history museum. And the beast, by some referred to as Birger, named by the tourism board, is used in schools to teach kids about waste management and all of that, but even as a way to discuss regional identity with school children. The monster can be useful in some aspect, but it's also a darker side to all of this because state funding has gone to, trying to catch the creature, and in other senses too. The first case we have where tax money go to catching the creature is when the King of Sweden, Oscar II, sponsor a company to catch the beast using this trap we see to the right. It was baited with a pig. They didn't catch anything. But it's continued to our days. EU funding has gone to put up reconnaissance places to see catch the sea monster. They serve as picnics locations too, but that was not the intended idea. It was to actually catch the monster. Now, the monster has also become a protected species for a while. And it started with a request from the local tourism board to the county board. And, Swedish law prohibits cryptological creature to become a protected species, but they didn't really care for that. And the process was forced through by the county board in 1986. And the inquest behind it took about a year. And they reached out to several parties, like your local sailing club, the history museum, and a society promoting the existence of the sea monster. The only biologist they talked to was the fishing superintendent, but nobody else was asked, and the fishing superintendent was not amused by this idea. But the whole material in this inquest is really fascinating. We could spend an hour talking about that. But my favorite part of it was when the board reached out to the British embassy to figure out how Loch Ness became a protected species. And they got an answer from the Scottish Development Department, who answered that Nessie is not a protected species because you can't, prove that it exists. It's hard to protect something that nobody knows exists. And adding, quote, "There are ample accommodation in the highlands and plentiful supplies of the national beverage which can help you see her in the dark." So the protection of the lake monster ended in 2002. Well, it was because an aspiring sea serpent farmer tried to get exemption to collect monster eggs so he can, you know, grow them in his backyard or whatever his plan was. And the county board says, no, you can't have that. And he said, well, then I go to the court. So he went to the court who said, we can't really, this, it doesn't exist. We can't make a decision on these guys. And that caught attention from other, well, investigative bodies in Sweden that tried to monitor all of this, who then said, guys, you can't protect a cryptozoological creature. You have to take it back. And they had to do that in 2002. And so while the sea monster can serve as a historical and identical positive force, it can also waste quite a bit of taxpayer money.
And we approached Godwin's Law immediately with the first question from Anonymous. Was the story of the Swedish lake monster ever the object of fascination for the Nazis, especially with their own stone and all?
Not that I've been able to see, at least. I didn't look into that aspect. Could there be... I don't know, actually. I have no idea to that question.
Why did people respect the runestones? If they were something that just boats, why they were preserved?
Because they carry, in most cases, Christian symbols on them. So we kind of associate the runestones with Vikings as pagans, but these were created in an era where Christianity and paganism lived side by side. So we have this pagan influence, but we also have these important Christian symbols on them, meaning that they want to preserve them in that sense. So they wasn't looked upon as pagan. They just couldn't read it. They saw the crosses, figure out, well, this is Christianity, therefore we can't really smash it to pieces. There's many, many cases where the stones are smashed to pieces, but yeah, many of them has actually survived due to their Christian symbols.
The next question from Klingenberg, I'm so sorry. How did the funding request for EU sea monster hunting funding look like? How was the target?
I think they targeted, it was made by the county tourism board. So I guess they kind of snuck in that, oh, you can go here and, you know, strengthen the tourism in the area. But it was mainly influenced, as far as I understood it, by the sea monsters hunters in the area.
The next question from Igor, he's somewhere over there. I've noticed that all the northern cryptozoo animals look similar to each other. Is it the flow of culture, or is it because the logs float similarly in the colder lakes?
Could you do it again?
All the similarities between the northern crypto monsters are because the culture just flows and people talk to each other, or because it's the same physical phenomenon they misinterpret?
No, I think it's that we talk to each other and the stories survive through generations in that sense.
And the next question is from Alistair. How valuable is cryptozoology tourism, and is it harmless?
I think it's a very complex question. I mean, the tourism board in Östersund, where, well, most of the monster fascination is, I mean, they gain a lot of money on it, it seems like. Otherwise, they wouldn't put it in most of their promotional material. But I didn't really look into how much money they actually make, unfortunately.
The next from... You keep making me pronounce this stuff. Tom... Carruthers, are there any similarities between European lake monsters and the Australian Aboriginal Yowie?
That's a bit beyond my scope as an archaeologist, I have to say.
And the last one from Adam. So, should we forget about the Viking?
Do we have 2 hours? But we should reimagining how we view the Vikings, because what we see in popular culture and American culture identity is not really what we see in the archaeological evidence. The term Viking is problematic, but as from my perspective, it's the best term, we have to incorporate a culture that spread through Scandinavia, through Poland, Russia, the Baltics, through Iceland to America. It's hard to find a common name for this culture that really captures everything. So the term is problematic, but currently the best one I've seen.
I see the talk for Skeptics in the Pub Online brewing, so watch the space. Thank you very much, Fredrik.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub Online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.